Killer Steel, third in the Electrifying Steel series by JD Masters. For Susan Savage, with special thanks to Marge Schoden and Kevin Bishop. Chapter 1. Lieutenant Donovan Steele came awake to the sound of a piercing scream. Reacting by instinct, he threw himself out of bed. He was naked, but he was not unarmed. A compensated polymer ceramic gun barrel slid out of his forearm through a gun port in the palm of his right hand. A dart launcher extruded from inside his left forearm. The gun fired 10mm bullets from a 15-round magazine built into his artificial Nysteel arm. The dart launcher, fed by a built-in 20-round magazine, was capable of firing titanium-tipped stun or poison darts, launching them hydraulically, or explosive rocket darts that were electrically primed with a millifuse time to ignite 20 feet downrange for rocket propulsion out to 100 yards. The weapon systems were slave to his cybernetic brain, which made them completely thought-controlled, with his built-in laser designator and thermal imaging systems, as well as image enhancement and night vision. Steel could not miss, but there was no target anywhere in sight.
Steel?
Raven said, sitting up in bed, her jet-black hair hanging down into her eyes, her voice still thick with sleep. She saw him standing by the side of the bed, crouching slightly, arms held out before him. His head moved quickly as he scanned the darkness of their room, his eyes glowing with twin pinpoints of red light.
What is it?
She said, coming suddenly alert. He moved over to the bedroom door and listened intently for a moment. His hearing turned all the way up. There was not a sound beyond the door in the penthouse apartment. The only sounds he heard were those of his own and Raven's heartbeats, like deep drums to his amplified hearing, and the heavy sounds of their own breathing. He opened the bedroom door and checked outside.
What is it? What's the matter?
Raven said, coming up behind him. They were both naked, but unlike Steel, her slim, long-legged body was not particularly constructed out of Nysteel and polymer, and her flesh was no proof against bullets. Stay back! Said Steel. He went out into the apartment and quickly looked around, then went out into the balcony. There was no sign of intruders. The city glowed quietly beneath him. He turned and saw her standing just behind him, a 9mm semi-automatic clutched in her right hand. Most women would have grabbed something to cover themselves with. Raven grabbed a gun. Unlike most women, she was completely unself-conscious about nudity. The years she'd spent as a hooker had inured her to that sort of thing. She was not self-conscious about anything. I thought I told you to stay back, he said.
And hide under the covers while somebody takes shots at you?
She said.
Honey, you've got the wrong girl. What's going on?
He frowned. I don't know! I heard a scream. It woke me.
Maybe it was just another dream.
She said. His nightmares were occurring with increasing regularity. Nightmares in which he relived fragments of experiences that were completely alien to him, and yet, at the same time, hauntingly familiar. He knew the cause. He knew it all too well. But there was nothing he could do about it. It began when he had been assigned to Project Download, volunteered by his chief as a test subject for a government experiment in brain-computer interface. They wanted to see if the knowledge and capabilities that he had gained from years of patrolling the bombed-out, lawless streets of no man's land could be downloaded from his brain, stored in a computer, and then passed on to another individual who had no experience in such things. It was an experiment aimed at enhancing human learning ability. They had implanted a biochip into his cerebral cortex, a semi-organic picoprocessor patterned on DNA and grown in a petri dish that would enable his brain to communicate with a computer and vice versa. They had conducted a number of experimental downloading sessions, testing the procedure. In the process, they had acquired a file of his mental engrams. Shortly thereafter, Steele was ambushed in the performance of his duties, shot down by assassins armed with automatic weapons. His torn and bleeding body had been rushed to an emergency room, but he had arrived in a coma, a victim of irreversible brain damage. They were able to keep him alive with life support, but there was nothing further they could do for him. Enter the CIA in the person of one Oliver Higgins, the agency executive in charge of Project Download. Steele's body, still on life support, was transferred to the top secret laboratories in the federal building, where the still-functioning biochip implanted in his brain enabled them to download the contents of his mind, while multiple teams of surgeons and cybernetics engineers worked around the clock, performing the long and highly complicated series of operations that transformed Steele into a cyborg, part man and part machine. His arms and legs were replaced with sophisticated Nysteel prosthetics powered by a tiny, shielded fusion generator implanted in his chest. His skeletal system was reinforced, parts of it replaced entirely with super-strong, articulated Nysteel alloy. Organ transplants were effected to replace those parts that had been shredded by the armor-piercing bullets, against which his body armor had been woefully inadequate protection. burned over 3/4 of his body by the flaming wreckage he'd been trapped in. His skin was repaired with polymer grafts, indistinguishable from ordinary human skin, but far stronger and highly resistant to bullets. Micro-miniaturized sensors provided feeling in his artificial limbs and skin. His eyes were replaced with bionic optics. His damaged organic brain was removed. In its place, an electronic brain was installed, encased in a nice steel cranium. And then they programmed him. Programmed him with the mental engrams they had taken from his own organic brain. His mind, his personality, his identity, his very soul translated into software and programmed into a cybernetic brain. A computer far more efficient than his human brain had ever been. The result was Project Steel. An experimental cyborg. A living, breathing prototype of the new weapon of tomorrow. The first man in history with a computer for a brain. But the damage to his organic brain was so severe that a lot of data in the form of mental engrams had been lost. The team of cybernetic engineers, headed by the brilliant Dr. Philip Gates, had to debug the program before it could be loaded into his artificial brain. To do this, they had utilized the mental engram files they had recorded from him previously during the experiments in which he had participated. But they had also augmented the program with what Dr. Gates had called ancillary data, bits and pieces of mental engrams they had filed from other test subjects in experiments similar to those that Steele had taken part in. This ancillary data had been integrated into Steele's engram matrix, meant only to augment his emotional responsivity. Okay, and nothing more, but it in fact did a great deal more. The first dream hadn't even been a nightmare, really. There was nothing to it that would have frightened anyone, but Steele awoke from it feeling chills running down his spine. He had dreamed it was a warm, sunny day and he was with his family in the park. He didn't know which park it was, or even in what city. It had seemed familiar, yet it wasn't. His wife was laying out on their picnic lunch on a blanket while their children were playing with the dog. It was a pleasant and bucolic scene. Only there was something wrong with it. They never had a dog. Steele's ex-wife, Janice, was a blonde. And this woman was a brunette. They had two children, Jason and Corey. But in this dream, there had been three. Twin boys and a girl. They called him Daddy. And yet Steele did not know them. The dream recurred. Each time something new was added. Some new element. He remembered that the woman's name was Donna. Donna what? He didn't know. She was not his wife. She did not look anything like his wife. And yet, he felt he had been married to her. It was crazy. In subsequent dreams, the scene became even more surreal. And more horrifying. His mother appeared in them. The children were playing in the park when suddenly, with the abruptness of a camera cut, it was dark. Late evening, and Steele's mother had appeared from out of nowhere, looking exactly as she had looked on that fateful day when she had come home contaminated by a blood sample from the hospital where she had worked, infected with the deadly virus 3, a terrifying legacy of the biowar. She was a screamer. She had burst through the door of their apartment, her mind already driven insane by the disease, her clothing torn and shredded, her face and body a hideous mass of separating sores. She had kept screaming, "My children! My children!" Over and over she descended on Steele's two younger brothers, sweeping them up into her arms and covering them with deadly kisses. And then she'd started biting them. By the time Steele's father got her off them, they were already infected. He had struggled with his psychotic wife, who fought him with terrifying savagery. He finally shot her with his .45, but not before she had infected him as well. With grim determination and tears in his eyes, Steele's father had said goodbye to him, then shot his two infected sons and turned the pistol on himself. And then, just as in real life, in the nightmare, Steele's mother had descended on the children, only not his brothers, but his three children in the dream. And as the woman who was his wife, yet not his wife, screamed in terror, Steele woke up, gasping for breath and trembling violently. Each time it was the same. Memories of his own past overlapping with those of someone else's. Whose? He did not know. There was another dream. He was a young soldier, stationed at an agro-commune in upstate New York, standing guard duty over a cornfield, protecting it from raiders. Steele had never been in the army. He had never been to upstate New York. He had never even seen a cornfield. He lived in the city all his life, yet in the dream he was there, standing on the far edge of the field, listening to the wind rustling through the corn rows, occupied by thoughts of lust for the young farm girl who had snuck out to see him in the middle of the night. He had set his assault rifle down on the fence while they flirted and smoked cigarettes. And then she came into his arms and they sank down to the ground, kissing passionately, exploring one another's bodies, and then she straddled him as he lay down on his back, her firm young breasts bouncing as she thrust against him. Then there was a sharp hissing noise, and it sounded like a hammer striking meat, and a triangulated steel arrowhead came bursting through her chest. Blood splattered down on him, and she grunted and fell forward on his chest, the arrow protruding from between her breasts, piercing his skin. Horrified, he rolled her off him and scrabbled for his rifle with his pants down around his ankles. The first bullet took him in the shoulder as the raiders opened fire. That was all. Each time Steel awoke at that point of the dream, each time his cries of terror woke Raven up, and she was there to hold him, to reassure him, to provide him tangible reality for him to cling to. Yet the dream was real too. It had happened, not to Steel, but to someone else, someone who had been that young soldier and who had to have survived that raid in order for his memory to have become part of Steel's engram matrix. For that was what was happening. That ancillary data used to supplement his engram matrix had started to express itself through his subconscious. In his dreams, he was reliving parts of other people's lives, memories and experiences that weren't his, yet that were now a part of him, floating somewhere in the programming of his cybernetic brain. A part of him now had been that soldier, had made love to that girl and seen her die. A part of him had once been married to that woman named Donna. His mind was being haunted by cybernetic ghosts, fragments of other people's personalities, and there was nothing he could do about it. He didn't dare tell Oliver Higgins or Philip Gates. He was afraid to trust Devin Cooper, the project psychiatrist. He knew only too well what their response would be. They would consider the dreams to be glitches in his programming, and they would bring him in, put him on downtime, and proceed to debug his engram matrix to erase the ghost personality fragments from his mind. Only what else might they erase in the process? The process of psychocybernetics was still in its infancy, and Steel was its first progeny. There was still much they did not know. They had not known about the effects of the ancillary engram data. They had not, could not have foreseen it. And though his personality had been translated into software, the subconscious was a far more complicated thing than even the most sophisticated artificial intelligence computer program. It was like a vast and incredibly intricate spiderweb. Touch one strand and all the others quiver. Break one. If he allowed them to debug his engram matrix, Steel knew that he might not come out the same. They would undoubtedly rewrite the program in a way that would allow him to still function. But how much of himself would he have lost? Already plagued by doubts and about his own humanity, Steel was determined to hang on to his identity, whatever he had left of his own soul, at any cost. Was he afraid to tell them what was happening? He was afraid of what they'd do. Somehow he'd have to exorcise these cybernetic ghosts all on his own, or find a way to come to terms with them. The trouble was, he had no idea how. He stood naked on the balcony, feeling the warm breeze through the sensors in the polymer skin of his artificial limbs, and through the pores of the natural, organic skin on his face, his buttocks, and the area of his groin. That had been one of the first things Raven had been curious about when they had met. Yes, he had told her it was real, a reality she eventually explored quite fully to discover, to her amazement, one of the hidden benefits of a man who was part flesh, part and blood, and part computer. She lowered the gun and put the safety back on.
"Only a dream,"
she said.
"Maybe that's all it was."
Steel shook his head, uncertain. "Maybe. I don't know. It was so real. I heard it. Distinctly. A man's scream." He went back inside the apartment and picked up the phone.
"What are you doing?"
she said.
"Who are you calling this time of night?"
He hesitated, still holding the phone. "Maybe I better check down with security," he said. "Check with them, just in case."
"There's nothing wrong,"
she said.
"It was only a dream, that's all. Look, if anything was wrong, we would have heard from them by now."
"Maybe you're right."
"Come on,"
she said, coming up to him and rubbing his chest lightly.
"Relax and come to bed."
"I suppose you're right," he said. "The damn nightmares are so real. Still, it can't hurt to check, just to make sure. It'll only take a second." He punched the number for the security desk downstairs.
"Security?"
The voice sounded tense, abrupt. "This is Steel," he said. "Is everything all right down there?"
"I was just coming up to see you, sir,"
the security man said. "What is it?" Steel said quickly.
"There's been an alarm at Project Headquarters,"
the security man said.
"I don't know what it is. They tried to call you just now, but your phone was off the hook, so they called me and..."
"I'm on my way," said Steel.
Wait,
said the guard quickly.
They're sending over a chopper to pick you up. It should be there any minute.
Right, said Steele, hanging up the phone. Christ, I should have realized.
What is it?
Raven said, seeing the expression on his face.
What's the matter?
Something happened at the Project Labs, he said, as he rushed back into the bedroom to get dressed. That scream I heard was no dream. It must have been Gates. He was trying to reach me through the broadcast link, and something happened. Something terrible. They're sending over a chopper for me right away.
I'm going with you.
No, you stay right here where it's safe, he said. They wouldn't lay you down there anyway. You haven't got the clearance. He zipped up his jumpsuit.
Call me the minute you find out what's going on,
she said.
Don't make me sit here worrying. You hear me?
I'll call you as soon as I can, said Steele. He heard the sound of the chopper blades as the helicopter came into the penthouse helipad. Christ, he thought, what the hell could have happened down there? Whatever it was, he'd soon find out. He kept thinking about that awful scream and how it was cut off abruptly. The chopper landed on the helipad on the roof of the federal building, once the headquarters of the United Nations in the days before the bio war. It had been a war not so much of nation against nation as of man against disease, and man had lost. Somehow, a group of Islamic terrorist fanatics had gotten hold of a genetically engineered biological agent and an airborne virus created in the lab, and in an effort to bring down the Western powers to their knees, they had released it simultaneously in several major cities in North America and Europe. However, they had vastly underestimated its virulence and the incredible speed with which it would spread throughout the world. Billions had died in a matter of days. The human organism had absolutely no defense against it. The major superpowers, each thinking the other responsible, had immediately ordered retaliatory strikes, but only a small portion of their nuclear arsenals were actually launched as missile control personnel keeled over at their posts. Within days, the population of the world had been reduced to a mere fraction of what it had once been. Governments collapsed. Anarchy reigned. Both Washington, D.C. and Moscow, as well as a number of other major cities throughout the world, had been nuked right off the face of the earth. There were still radioactive hotspots throughout the areas of what had once been the United States, Europe, and the Soviet Union. The missile strikes in California had triggered off devastating earthquakes, but the loss of life throughout, brought about by the aborted nuclear exchange was nothing compared to that caused by the plague. Humanity would have been wiped out completely had not the virus started to undergo a rapid series of mutations, and a fortunate few had somehow managed to acquire an immunity, but countless others had succumbed before the virus finally mutated into a relatively harmless organism that posed a threat only to the very old and weak, those whose immune systems had no longer functioned properly. Billions had succumbed not only to the virus in its original form, but to its succeeding incarnations, one of which attacked the myelin sheaths of the nervous system, resulting in a progressively crippling disease that left its victims gradually wasting away. Another resulted in the deadly virus 3, the disease that had produced the Screamers, a carrier population of victims that was left physically and mentally ravaged by the disease. Screamers were hopelessly psychotic. They attacked anything that moved, and they were highly contagious. Those of their victims who survived became infected, turning into screamers themselves within a matter of hours or even minutes. Driven stark, raving mad by the disease and breaking out in hideous, festering sores as their bodies literally rotted away. One screamer could create hundreds more before the disease finally consumed him, and the police and armed citizenry shot them down on sight. But though the carrier population had been cut down severely since the war, the disease proved stubborn to eradicate. Many of its victims still ran amok like howling beasts out in the countryside and in the lawless, devastated sections of the cities once known as No Man's Land, still known as No Man's Land, where outlying enclaves and paramilitary street gangs ruled the turf, and the beleaguered population struggled for survival in a dark and savage urban jungle. Such was the world in which Steele functioned as an agent of the weakened and woefully decentralized federal government, with headquarters in New York's Midtown, an embattled nucleus of a city bordered to the north and south by no man's land. The federal building, which had once flown the flags of all the countries belonging to the United Nations, now flew the state flags of the crippled USA, all save Texas, which had left the Union to form its own republic with its capital in Dallas. The federal building now housed the offices of the legislators and government agencies. What had once been the government, the General Assembly building now housed the Hall of Congress, where the elected representatives faced the seemingly insurmountable task of uniting the country once again as modern civilization slowly staggered back from the brink of oblivion. Buh. As Steele took the elevator down from the roof of the building to the maximum security sub-basements, he was escorted by a group of federal security agents armed with pistols and automatic weapons. They stood beside him in the elevator, silent and impassive, but their faces were all drawn and tense. Steele knew better than to ask what had happened. If they knew, even knew precisely, they would not be authorized to tell him. They did not stop on the 22nd floor where the administrative offices of the project and the CIA were, but continued straight down into the basement, where he passed a security checkpoint and changed into another elevator that would take him down to a maximum security sub-basement levels. On level B3, he stepped out of the elevator and into what looked like the interior of a concrete bunker. The first things he saw were the dead bodies of Marine guards, not uniformed in full dress or security blues as the rest of the soldiers in the building, but in full combat gear. They lay scattered about like so much chaff, their bodies torn and broken. Blood was everywhere, in large puddles on the floor and splattered on the walls and ceilings. Steele caught his breath at the grisly sight. The guards quickly escorted him out of the elevator and past the security station where there were more bodies on the floor and draped over consoles. The massive steel barred door that gave entrance to the underground laboratory complex was a torn and twisted wreckage. Steele stared at it with disbelief. What in God's name could have done that? Adrenaline surging through his system, he hurried down to the corridor. The walls were chipped and bullet scarred, shattered and blackened from grenade explosions. Bodies. Bodies everywhere. And blood. So much blood. The heavy steel door to the main laboratory complex lay on the floor, ripped off its hinges, and the lab complex itself was a shambles. Heavily armed security guards bustled back and forth along with white lab-coated medical personnel. It was pandemonium, flames licked from ruined electronic equipment as lab personnel shot them with fire extinguishers. Sparks shot out from smashed computer banks and consoles, and there were more bodies lying sprawled out on the floor, draped over pieces of equipment, in impossibly twisted positions as if they'd been hurled there. Steele's first thought was a hit. A well-organized, heavily armed assault team. But who? How? To his knowledge, only the outlaw enclaves on Long Island could have mustered up a force and weaponry sufficient to the task. In the aftermath of the biowar, organized crime had been gone truly big time. Not long ago, Steele had led an assault upon the enclave of the powerful Borodini family out in Cold Spring Harbor. Victor Borodini and his sons had led the most powerful of the criminal enclaves. He dealt with the Brood, the heavily armed biker enclave out in Montauk, who supplied them with necessities from their agro-commune and fishing fleets. He traded with the freebooters who roamed the Atlantic coast and the Caribbean, supplying them with drugs and ordnance. The Borodinis had even extended their criminal operations into the city, bringing most of the gangs in no man's land under their control. Their enclave had been heavily fortified, protected by armed mercenaries, shore batteries, mines placed throughout the grounds of the estate and in the harbor, automated defense systems, and surface-to-air missiles. And the people who had gone to the Borodinis for protection provided an added measure of security, rendering any kind of tactical strike impossible without significant loss of innocent life. Steele had infiltrated the enclave and sabotaged their defense systems, allowing an assault force to come in by chopper. But though the enclave had fallen, Rick Borodini had taken a group of federal legislators hostage, and in order to secure their release, it had been necessary to trade the prisoners, including Victor Borodini and his youngest son, for the hostages. Could this have been the work of Victor Borodini? A payback for the assault upon his enclave? Perhaps, Steele thought, but if so, then why were there no indications of it out on the outside of the building and its grounds? How could they have gotten past the exterior defenses, past the heavily armed security force inside the building, and down to the maximum security levels without any sign of struggle? No, thought Steele, as the guards conducted him through the wreckage of the lab complex. Whoever or whatever had caused all of this had come from the inside, from within the lab itself. What the hell had they been doing in here? He stopped suddenly as two guards came by carrying a stretcher. It was covered with a bloody sheet, but the sheet had slipped enough to show the body's face. It was Dr. Philip Gates. "Wait!" he said. He pulled back the sheet. He flinched at the sight. In his years on the NYPD strike force, he'd seen more dead bodies than he could count, but never one like this. There was a gaping, bloody hole in the center of Gates' chest, or what his chest had been. The crushed and splintered ribcage looked as if it had imploded. Blood-stained bones framed the horrible damage within. Steele stared down at the corpse and swallowed hard, his throat constricting, his stomach churning. Torn arteries hung limp and loose inside the bloody, congealing mass that had once been Dr. Philip Gates. His heart had been torn out. Steele dropped the sheet and turned away. The guards led him toward the back of the lab complex and into a windowless wood-paneled office with thick carpeting and a long conference table in the center of the room. Higgins was there, along with some senior military staff officers and agents. Dev Cooper was there as well. He was shouting at Higgins as Steele came into the room. All activity came to an immediate halt. A thick silence descended. "Steele," said Higgins, turning to him. "What the hell happened here?" asked Steele. With the exception of Dev Cooper and Higgins, they were all looking at him strangely. He had seen that look before. He knew it all too well. "Everybody out," said Higgins. They hesitated. "Out, I said," shouted Higgins. Still never heard him raise his voice before. He had never seen the icy, unflappable Higgins lose his self-control. Dell hurried toward the door. Not you, Cooper, Higgins said. He took a deep breath and let it out slowly. Please, I'd like you to stay for this.
Jesus Christ, Higgins, Steele said. What's going on? What the hell happened?
Sit down, Steele. Higgins glanced up at the guards and said, leave us. Shut the door. I don't want to be interrupted. Steele glanced from him to Cooper. The psychiatrist looked terrible. There were deep bags under his eyes. He looked as if he hadn't slept in days. There's been, Higgins groped for the right word, an incident, he finished lamely.
An incident, said Cooper. Is that what you call it?
Doctor, please. Cooper sat down at the table and took out a pack of cigarettes. He lit one with a trembling hand.
Who did this, Higgins? Steele said. What did this?
Higgins grimaced tightly. Cyborg, he said. Steele stared at him.
What? A cyborg, said Dev tersely. They built themselves another cyborg. Only this one went berserk, ran totally amok. He killed both Dr. Gates and Dr. Gold. Dr. Nakamura's in the hospital, in critical condition. It doesn't look as if she's going to make it. Half the project team is dead, and the others are all either severely wounded or in shock. He went through the lab like a one-man demolition crew and then broke out. The soldiers couldn't stop him. He slaughtered everyone who tried to get in his way.
He escaped through the shuttle platform on level B1, said Higgins, jumped down onto the tracks and broke through into one of the sealed-off connecting subway tunnels. There's no telling where he may have gone from there. The old subway system runs all throughout New York City. Most of those tunnels haven't been used in years.
He could come up anywhere, said Cooper warily. Anywhere in the city. And he's stock, staring, raving mad.
End of chapter.